All right, so welcome to another edition of the Generative AI in the Real World podcast. And today we have Gwendolyn Stripling of Google Cloud, where she works on AI, machine learning, and data analytics. And she also happens to be the author, co-author of an O'Reilly book called Low-Code AI. So Gwendolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Ben. Thank you for having me.
And I love the title, and I actually like this whole area of low-code, no-code software. But for our listeners, Gwendolyn, just to set the stage, I think the term no-code is obvious, right? So there's no code. So low-code, for this, in the context of your book, what's the boundary between code and low-code?
That's an excellent question. Actually, I had that very question yesterday when I presented at the Open Data Science Conference East in Boston. And how I like to distinguish it is, as you said, Ben, with no code, that's quite obvious, right? There's no coding at all. You can actually build and train a machine learning model without writing a single line of code. And so the question then becomes, as you've stated, is then what is low code? So when I think about low code, I think about what is the minimal amount of code that is needed to achieve a business goal in terms of a machine learning problem, whether it's a prediction problem, a classification problem, or a clustering problem. And so if you were to actually really code and build a machine learning model, if you will, a pipeline in Python, it would take about, I think, over 70 or 80 lines of code, if not more. And in our book, actually, I do just that. I show an example of the full coding of a business case that we reference in the book. And then I say, well, this is how you would have to do it if you didn't use Keras, for example. And Keras is a great library because it's an API that sits on top of TensorFlow. And what it does is it takes away all that sort of heavy lifting that you'd have to do if you were to code a machine learning library. And so in six lines of code, you can build your neural network. If you're using the Keras sequential model, you can build your neural network, you can compile it with one line of code, and you can fit the model with 1.5 lines of code. So 6 lines of code to build, compile, and fit a machine learning model versus about 60 lines of code to do that very thing. And so low-code AI is really using the most, the minimal amount of code necessary to achieve your goal and solve your problem.
So in that sense, Gwendolyn, back in the day, right? So before libraries like scikit-learn, you would have to hand code a lot of those models and algorithms yourself. Obviously, with scikit-learn, you now have a library and you have higher level interfaces, and you can focus on solving the business problem at hand, as you described. So there's code. So there's amount of code, right? So no code, low code. How does that change the amount of knowledge as far as machine learning, algorithms? You know what I mean? So if I'm a proficient coder and I'm not afraid of code, but I'm afraid of ML, so what's the interplay there?
Okay, that's a great question. And if I can take a moment to step back too. You brought up scikit-learn and the abstraction layers that are used now to sort of take away some of the heavy lifting. There are open source AutoML machine learning libraries, but they still require some coding. So there's a difference between AutoML that's completely GUI-based, drag and drop, that mostly all the cloud vendors have. Then there's this sort of open source model where you have AutoML, but there's still some coding. To your question, if you are someone who knows coding, But once you engage more on the machine learning journey, like how do you get started and how does it help you if you don't really have to code, right? So I actually had that question about a year ago. Someone came up to me at Google Next and said, you know, I've been Java programming programmer. Back in the day kind of stuff like Fortran, COBOL, like, you know, how do I pivot, right? And so I said to him, you're actually in a sweet spot because you understand programming. So how do you now start your machine learning journey? What's great about a person like that in terms of where they are is if you can start with AutoML, where you can load your data set into, you know, a platform, have it perform exploratory data analysis for you, basically based on the data set, it determines, you say, well, it's a regression problem or a classification problem. The AutoML platform will determine what kind of algorithm is best suited. And it will then, within a few clicks, it will give you a model with some really great results then. So why is that important? Well, when you're learning machine learning, it's, in my mind, it's not about the tools, it's about the business case and the data. And so typically programmers have been abstracted away from them. There have been someone else in the front, you know, talking about the use case and the business case. There's that sort of stakeholder, and then there's that product manager or program manager, and then there's that person who tells this programmer what to do. And sometimes that business requirements document captures everything, and sometimes there are gaps. So what AutoML does is it allows that person to sort of self-learn about what is the difference between I have a business problem, and is it I'm trying to predict something, or am I trying to classify something, or am I trying to cluster something? And most of these vendor platforms, they kind of guide you, and you learn as you're selecting the right objective. And so that's where it helps, because you're learning as you're going versus throwing a whole bunch of ML code at you and saying, this is what this does. If you start with AutoML, you get some really baseline metrics, and then you also learn what the objective is, you learn what it's doing, and then you can actually begin to evaluate the metrics. So that's like a baseline start for learning ML.
So in closing, looking ahead 5 years, what is the profession of data scientist and what is the profession of ML engineer? What do they look like?
You're asking questions. I always say to myself, when I have time to reflect, I'm going to reflect on those. And you're asking me now. Okay. 5 years from now, the data scientist and the ML engineer, you are familiar with this graphic, right, where you show there are all these blocks about machine learning, and then there's a little block that says ML code. Like there's this little block that says, you know,
yep, famous
yes,
paper
exactly.
From Google.
And it says why machine learning models never get into production, right? And I think 5 years from now, that diagram is going to be drastically different because of generative AI, right? And so where is that role of data scientist? There are so many legacy systems, you know, and use cases that have been kind of stuck in a funnel because of that diagram, right, that I've mentioned. So I think that the data scientist is going to be more focused on the data piece of it, which is where all the where that bottleneck always kind of stops is the data wrangling. So I see more of that. The science piece, I think, is going to be handled by machines, you know. And I think then it becomes the data scientist can then begin to reflect and interpret more, you know, and they can begin to map that use case requirement to the evaluation interpretation. They'll have more time for that because that's what's been missing. It's the data kind of creates the bottleneck. The code creates the bottleneck. The whole project never gets kind of done. If it gets done, it's 5 years later. And I think if we can let the machines do the heavy lifting, in the use case, the data, and the interpretation and the implementation, there's more resources assigned in those on those levers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the O'Reilly Podcast, Generative AI in the Real World. If you want to listen to the full version, please log in to the platform at O'Reilly.com.